Right now, it's time for our monthly check-in on the world of science. Researchers around the world are trying to predict and prevent the next massive disease pandemic using math and mapping. And new evidence shows that one of the world's most beloved treats, chocolate, has been around a lot longer than we thought. We'll talk about the origins of chocolate and how it shaped the world. Plus, penguins. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hello, and happy science to you, my friend.
And to you, too, Gemma. We'll get to the fun stuff, the chocolate and penguins. Let's start with our most serious thing today, this effort to get early detection systems for diseases. Talk about what's at stake here. If we could get an early warning of diseases, how much is that going to help?
Well, you know, potentially, we as a species could be at stake. If you think about pandemics and just the devastation, you know, 100 years ago, the way the 1918 influenza pandemic devastated, millions of lives lost, it is possible that could happen again. And it's really surprising that for years, you've had epidemiologists and a variety of other researchers working on the question from different angles, but there wasn't a lot of places they could go, really, to pool their information and kind of cross-check what they were finding out. And so there's this whole new movement, a multidisciplinary movement afoot, where they are pulling together their information and looking at the problem from different angles, as you mentioned, through math, through the use of an artificial intelligence that's learning how to predict outbreaks, and also from more sophisticated mapping techniques that have never been used to study the possibility of an outbreak in a particular area.
A really common source of human diseases is other animals giving us those diseases in virus form. And that, it looks like, is one of the ways researchers around the world are trying to collaborate here and look at, okay, what animals are likely to give us diseases, what viruses are they carrying? That's a lot to tackle. What kind of efforts are out there?
Well, for example, there's one group that is compiling a database. It's called the Enhanced Infectious Diseases Database, EID2. And basically, they're looking at which diseases are present in which animals and what are the chances that those diseases can move, say, from an animal to a human, a process called zoonosis. And that's one team. There's another researcher who is teaching artificial intelligence to learn how to figure out, okay, if this pathogen, if this bacteria or virus exists in this host animal naturally, why does it exist in that host animal? And what are the other animals that are at risk of the pathogen jumping into them? And it's very complicated. It's extremely complicated to go in and identify the traits that those animals share that may make it possible for a pathogen to jump from one host species to another. So it's a complicated process, but she's, again, teaching artificial intelligence how to learn it, and the algorithms are getting better and better at identifying the most likely suspects. So that's just two ways of looking at the host animal. There's another team that's looking at biodiversity, because the more diversity in wildlife and species present that an area has, the more likely you're going to find pathogens, and the more likely that different species will, you know, bump up against each other in some way, and that the pathogens will have a chance to jump from one host to another.
One other road that people are following, there are a lot of genome scans of different species and viruses out there. There are journal articles about them, but there's not, you know, if you're reading a big complicated book, you want that index to look stuff up. There's not really a solid index, it sounds like, where if I'm a researcher looking at a new disease, I want to compare and contrast. It's really hard to find this stuff.
Exactly, and that's one of the goals of the Enhanced Infectious Diseases Database that I mentioned, that they are really trying to compile all this information from all these different sources, looking at various aspects of both the host species and the pathogen itself. And one of the things I think is really interesting about this new effort is that there's a special mapping project underway, and this kind of thing has never really been done before, and when you hear it, you think, well, this makes sense, but no one has ever really gone in and found a way to map how an outbreak, once it's established, once people are getting infected and spreading a pathogen, how it spreads, and to identify the areas and the people most at risk for it to spread too, and to start hopefully preventive treatments, whether it be vaccines or quarantines or something. No one has ever really investigated how to do that on a super granular scale, kind of going block by block in a neighborhood, for example. And there's a whole new project with the British Red Cross and other groups underway to figure out, once a pathogen rears its ugly head, who is most at risk for kind of that second ring of infection and the third ring? How do we stop that spread once a pathogen shows up in a human population?
These are just a few of the methods that are in an article in Discover Magazine. It seems like the common thread is, hey, we're going to use big data and our power with modern computing to crunch that data to learn lessons that we would have been kind of guessing at just 20 years ago or so.
Exactly. Big data and artificial intelligence, and there's a lot of cross-pollination of different fields. You know, for example, biologists are working with mathematicians in a way they haven't worked with previously to kind of pool their different approaches and find the best way forward.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. Let's turn now, Gemma, to a favorite topic of yours, human prehistory, and a favorite topic of mine, chocolate. It turns out we humans have liked chocolate for a lot longer than we used to think.
Yeah, and what really fascinated me about this new research is that we find chocolate did not originate in Mexico or Central America. I think you hear a lot of talk, a lot of people say, oh, you know, I know people who do chocolate tourism, and they go to all these different stops in Mexico and Central America where they think that's the birthplace of chocolate. And it's actually, this new research, which was a multidisciplinary effort, found really the first evidence that chocolate originated in South America, that's where the cacao tree was first domesticated, that's where chocolate was first processed and eaten and, you know, I'm assuming enjoyed.
One thing I've learned, I think from you, Gemma, actually, is that if we want to find the birthplace of a species or a kind of plant, we want to go where there's the most genetic diversity, the most subspecies of it. And that was one of the clues here, right? The most different kinds of the original chocolate plant are in this part of South America.
Yeah, it's the upper Amazon basin, kind of the area that's now Ecuador and Peru, and there are more than 9 Theobroma species. It's Theobroma cacao is the specific domesticated plant, but there are other species, and also its wild ancestor is also most genetically rich in that particular area. So that's where they were able to confirm using ancient DNA that they found from plant residues on artifacts at archaeological sites. That's another way that they confirmed, yes, these people were domesticating Theobroma cacao and eating it.
When we think of chocolate around the world, we think of phrases sometimes like Dutch chocolate, Belgian chocolate, Swiss chocolate, that kind of thing. These are alien species, right, for the old world. These are newcomers to the cuisine of Europe, Asia, you name it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Theobroma, the entire genus, definitely originated in the Americas, and based on the latest information, looks like it was in the north part of South America, this upper Amazon basin that we're talking about. That's where genetic diversity is richest for it. And so it looks like all signs are that it originated there. And then all, you know, we think of dark chocolate and milk chocolate. Those are all 19th century European inventions that happened way, 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 way after chocolate was already long loved and very important to the Americas.
I want to take a few minutes now, Gemma, for penguins. You wrote a piece, just a kind of 20 things we didn't know about penguins. I want to touch on some of those. One, they're not around anymore, but there used to be 200-pound penguins in the wild.
Yes, there are a few species, such as Anthopornis and Kumamonu. They're extinct, so nobody worry about a giant penguin showing up at your door. But, yeah, they think they were 6 feet or taller and weighed about 200 pounds. Think of that. That's, you know, that's a lot of happy feet right there.
Fuel for all our penguin-related nightmares. Now, talk a little more. Why did you want to tackle the issue of penguins, Gemma?
Well, who doesn't love penguins? I mean, they're marvelous animals. And, you know, when I was in Antarctica, my favorite thing was to go watch the penguins. I lived down there for a while at McMurdo Station, and you could just spend your entire day sitting out there and just watching the penguins moving in and out of the water, sliding around on their bellies. They're adorable. They're fascinating. And I think they're kind of different than a lot of people think. A lot of people think all penguins are in Antarctica. That's not true. There are only two species that are exclusive to Antarctica. Most penguins live in places that don't even get snow, like Peru and South Africa. And so there are all these interesting facts that I think because, you know, because of Happy Feet, because of March of the Penguins, because of all the pop culture penguins out there, that the true truth of penguins has been obscured.
Well, when we watch dinosaur movies and see the T-Rex in them, we don't watch and think, oh, there were penguins in the world at this time. But it looks like, yeah, there probably were.
Yeah, there may have been. We don't know because we don't have the fossils of the very earliest penguins. The earliest penguin fossils we do have, they're about 61 million years old. And what's really interesting is that there are a few different species of penguins already around at that time, 61 million years ago, which tells paleontologists that penguins as a thing were already established. And were already pretty diverse. There were several different kinds of penguins, and they were very different from each other. So that tells us that their roots, the very first penguins, go back further in time. And the latest estimates are 66 or 67 million years ago, and that's well within the time of T-Rex.
So I'm seeing a Jurassic Park sequel, Gemma.
With a 200-pound penguin?
With a 200-pound penguin chasing us around, yeah. All right. Well, Gemma, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun, as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She's based in Waukesha, so is Discover Magazine. She joins us every month to highlight some cool stories in the world of science.